Today is February the 13th, 1973. The following interview is with Donna Kingwell, K-I-N-G-W-E-L-L, a member of the staff of Herbert Klein. The interview will take place in room 161 of the old executive office building. The interviewer is Terry Good. Secretary, I turned it back on and I got a bunch of static. It's picking up all right now, so we'll give it a try. As I said, the hardest type of interview for us to do is one with somebody we know something about, because it sounds like we're very ignorant. We're going to ask you some very basic questions. So please bear with me. When did you join the White House staff, approximately?
It was in June of 1971.
Yeah.
Your title while you were here?
Research assistant to Herbert G. Klein.
You always worked in this office, room 161?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
Records of your activities. Do you think somebody coming along 20 years from now, Donna, will be able to follow your assignments and responsibilities with any degree of understanding? Or is it one of those situations where it's going to be very difficult to find out what you did based upon the documentation?
I would say it would be the latter, because this is it's almost an instantaneous office. It's a demand type of office. It's, you know, we need this, we need it now. The only way that anyone could ever really see what we have done is through following some of the activities of Herb Klein. In other words, his speaking engagements and this type of thing on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month basis. We provided most of the input and speech excerpts and this type of thing for him. But as it is with the President of the United States, Herb Klein is the originator of that material, and not the speech writers or research office or anything else.
Okay, so everything...
I will say...
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, the one very tangible thing that someone could follow very easily, which I suppose could be credited to this office and primarily to Susie Lowe, who was here prior to my coming, and that was the fact that she had enough upstairs to grab those 68 campaign documents. And that has been of tremendous value to the entire White House staff and people outside of the building, the accumulation of those. And we learned by that to hang on to 72 material, even though he was President of the United States at the time, and vis-a-vis Walker and that type of thing, you have a pretty good a record of what he said during the 72 campaign. But nevertheless, there were materials that we kept and have since sent on to archives that we think will be of use to someone someday. For example, all of the McGovern material. All of our Democratic research material and this type of thing from the, you might say, congressional races through the presidential races that were used by Mr. Klein and various surrogate speakers as they were termed in the 72 campaign. We provided the input. The RNC was a great help in that respect in providing our office with input. But we felt that even though the RNC may have been the originator of a lot of material for the 72 campaign, that would not or may not get into the hands of the archives. So we learned from Susie's exercise in 68, and I suppose that is probably the most concrete or tangible evidence of this office would be simply that it that kind of material was kept.
Well, listen, I certainly...
Would it be fair to assume that anything relating to research preparations for Mr. Klein's speaking engagements would have been, at least in part, if not totally, accumulated, compiled, collected, and prepared in your office?
I would say 99% of it would be his briefings, packages, what we term briefing packages, which gave him, for example, if he were addressing the YMCA National Convention, the first thing we would do would be to secure a briefing package or material from the YMCA of a historical nature, so he has some background of the organization. We would find out also who was on the speaking platform with him and some background on that person. For example, if the oldest living YMCA or one of the founders or something like that, so that he could make an appropriate comment at the time. The research stretched over a vast area of his responsibility, from demographic material to his facts and figures and so forth for his speeches that he delivered at that time.
Were you the only person, or was Buttons also involved in calling these various places where he was going to speak to bring in the information?
Buttons was also very responsible in that manner, primarily at my direction, but nevertheless there were times...
Going to do a pretty good job.
Let's see, where did I leave off?
In terms of who actually was involved in collecting this information?
It would have been... I guess I started to say at my direction, she performed a lot of duties, but there were many times when she was left here on her own to fulfill these responsibilities as well. So I've always considered it a two-party operation.
But it is limited to just the two of you for what?
I would say primarily, plus the government agencies. You have to rely upon them to provide your background material. For example, Mr. Klein just left for Hanoi and Peking with Dr. Kissinger. Now, I had to rely, there was quite a flack the day before he left over cotton sales to China. And the only way that you can get a good background paper with any kind of insight into the situation, particularly since he's going there and it could very well come up, would be to notify the Department of Agriculture and ask them to prepare a background paper for his use. Through our public information officers, this is how we operate through the government agencies, is with our PIOs. And they in turn provided a two-page analysis of what was transpiring, what we were seeing in the newspapers and over the wires, with some greater in-depth insight into the situation. So I would have to certainly give credit to the government agencies and to our public information offices for providing us with everything from very simple information to very detailed information, because obviously we just don't have a facility here. Mort Allen's office is extremely responsible at all times for providing information for us, simply because of the number of newspapers and this type of thing that come through his office. And we are a research office, and we answer to a number of requests, not only within the Klein operation, but from all over. Inside and outside the White House.
Is that right?
Oh, yes.
For instance, who outside, let's say, the Klein operation is still within the complex?
Oh, Agnes calls me occasionally. Agnes Waldron, who's on Ron Ziegler's staff, has been known to call me, and I've been known to call her. And it's kind of a, as fellow researchers, I suppose you would say, we try to help one another with things.
How about the speech writers themselves, the Speakers Bureau, I think that's now been renamed the editorial?
Right. No, I would say, in that respect, extremely limited, because the speech writing operation has their own research division.
Right.
And occasionally we share, I would say, maybe 2%. If I had to draw it on a scale of 100%, probably 2% would be all they would utilize us. Now, we do utilize them a little more. They have more research facilities because they have more space. They can afford to keep, 6 months of newspapers. We can afford to keep 30 days.
Yeah.
their library is quite vast. And it, there again, we built up a fairly large library, but you just have to cut it off at some point simply because we did not have the room.
Do you ever do much with the domestic council people?
Again, as a source of information, during the last 2 years, when I can specifically stipulate that one of the first things I did when I came here was to do some in-depth research on the drug problem in this country for speaking engagements for Herb. And it was through the domestic council and the BNDD that I worked, but primarily through the people here in this building. And then the arm reached out into LEAA and the BNDD and justice and this type of thing to provide background information. From that, I read and drew my own conclusions and worked it into an outline for speeches that were given at different times throughout the states.
Is there any possibility of responding to the question, which agencies or departments did you use most frequently? Now, what I guess I'm asking is, what were the most frequent topics that Herb Klein addressed himself to? I don't suppose you'd be able to answer the question, but I feel obligated to ask.
Well, I think that that's a very easy question to answer. The topic which he addressed himself the most to was press communications. Anything dealing with the printed media or the electronic media. The relationship of the president and the press, the relationship of the federal government and the press. These, I would say, were the primary topics, although Herb was, as a newly established office, the first 4 years of the Nixon administration, it's been a very interesting office. It was an office that never existed before. And as director of communications, I think that this office performed a great service because it gave the press the added impetus of feeling as though that there was someplace besides, I think, the press office to go to. And when you look at the world of communication, everything is growing, and one man just can't possibly handle everything. And when you look at Mr. Ziegler's operation, I frankly don't know how he handles what he does. I mean, you know, when he has to answer to the president, for the president, on such a large spectrum. And this is the way I divide the two of them up. You have Ron Ziegler, who is a spokesman for the president, which is just a monstrous job in itself. And then you have Herb Klein, who becomes a spokesman for just about everything. And this is the thing that's intriguing about Herb himself, is that I don't think any man who didn't have a fantastic memory could possibly have held that position. Because when he goes out on the road, if you observe him, he can be asked anything from literally from birth control to, you know, what's the latest on the SALT talks, when's the war going to end. I mean, he has to not only understand domestic politics, but he has to understand foreign politics. Now, to go back to your question, in terms of the primary responsibility source that he addressed himself to, I would say would be the press communications. Over and above that, the agencies that I drew the most on would have been Justice and Interior and HEW. And the reasons for those are very obvious, because in the last 4 years, well, now I have to say the NSC in terms of foreign policy. Okay. Not so much on state, which is very interesting to me, because first of all, NSC provides more in-depth background material on a confidential basis or eyes-only basis, where the State Department normally will not release too much of that kind of material unless it's specifically requested by her. In other words, I have the feeling at times when I request things from the state, they're actually going back through the NSC anyway. That's my own thinking on that. the reason I chose the other agencies was simply because of the issues of the day. We're very, this nation is wrapped up in the environment. So you have a tendency to have many questions concerning the environment. And HEW, we seem to, in the last 8 to 10 years, have taken a very humanistic attitude towards the people of this country. So you have a tendency to have more of this type of activity, education, health, and this type of thing. And justice, because crime has been a very major problem in this country. So a lot of it is dictated by the format to which he decides he's going to address himself to. And that is stipulated sometimes by the organization that he's speaking to, and sometimes it's left entirely up to him. If he's speaking to a press club, which I would say were to a large extent prior to the election, that was primarily a primary group of individuals, the national press organizations throughout the country, the state organizations. They want to hear about press relations, everything from the president and the press to license renewals, this type of thing. Telecommunications just in the last 2 months has become a very big thing, and the problem over censorship, this type of thing. And then from there you go on to your civic organizations, and you know, Gersh, he's just addressed just about every kind of group I can think of, from world organization groups to
local civic groups, yeah, or something, on a very, like very local basis. You didn't say anything about the Department of Defense. Does that fall into the same category as state?
Yeah, I didn't think about that. No, it doesn't. That's tough. I'd have to divide it 50-50. I didn't even think about that, Terry, because I... yes, defense was of a great help to us on a statistical basis. So many times we'd have to update his material in terms of men withdrawn, the casualties. If there was something coming over a wire that was of an urgent nature, like the renewal of the bombing and this type of thing, oftentimes we would check with our public information officer over there to verify something. Any in-depth information on the negotiations during that period when the negotiations were taking place was provided for us by the NSC and not by defense. That would be my reading on it. In other words, again, I reverted back to NSC when it dealt with foreign policy, which I had kind of encompassed in that first statement there. But no, I cannot exclude defense. I would have to say yes, that it was an immense help to us.
I have been told by some people that Herb Klein probably traveled more than any other member of the president's staff. And if he didn't travel more than one or two others, he had to be right up there in the top two or three. Did you travel on any occasions with him, or did he generally take any of his staff with him on these trips?
Yes, he did. He did take his staff. He had Jenny Brown, who traveled with him most of the time. Now, I made several local trips with him, and but my position here is such that I can't afford to go with him and do my work at the same time. And particularly when he was gone for a week at a time in 6 or 7 different states. You know, at times I would send him off with the information for 3 states and then have to be working on the material for the end of the week, and he would fly in back into Washington for what, just an overnight stay and back out again, and he'd have to pick up all that material. If I were trying to travel with him and prepare material, it would just be ridiculous. Now, I did go on several things with him, but this was primarily just to listen to him speak, because I wanted an idea of how he handled audiences on a Q&A basis, how he delivered a speech, and this type of thing. I attended almost all of his appearances here in Washington, either on Meet the Press, Face the Nation, Issues and Answers, anytime he did a radio program here in the area, or a local television programs such as McCaffrey at Large or something like that, and I was usually with him at that time. But no, I did not do any extensive traveling, and Jenny Brown, I would have to say, would be the person that traveled with him the most, as and she is with his title of confidential secretary. But
well, I would have been surprised that you said yes, I traveled, because it didn't seem to be based upon what you said, that you could afford to be away from your base of operations.
No, it's too difficult, because you know, one thing that with her doing, I have to go back to the original question too, which I haven't answered, and that was, you know, did he, the original question was, you know, is he the most traveled? I think you'd have to perhaps match your mileage against Dr. Kissinger.
Oh, well.
But as far as talking to the American people, I would say, aside from the Vice President of the United States, and I frankly don't have any figures on that, I would have to say that he's either slightly ahead of the VP or running a pretty close second, or pretty close to him. I would think that the Vice President may have traveled more air miles. This has kind of been my own philosophy, rationalization of the situation. But Herb, I think, has been in more states than the Vice President has. This was the idea, this was the brainstorm of the President when he came into office, and that was to reach out, communicate with people. And I think Herb has attempted very effectively to do this. And I think the fruits of that came so much. We saw so many of those fruits. And I think this is extremely important, because in 1968, the President received more endorsements for President of the United States editorially than did Hubert Humphrey. But they ran very close together. They were almost neck and neck. And many more papers sat on the fence. Now, in 1972, I believe that the President garnered almost 89% support editorially from these newspapers.
As opposed to something like maybe 40% or something?
Yeah, it was way down.
Less than 50 for sure.
Yeah. And this was by working with the press, by the President taking enough of an interest in what papers outside of our so-called Eastern establishment papers. He wanted to know what other people were thinking and saying, and that's what a lot of this function of the whole Total Klein operation was to look at the Tulsa Daily Oklahoman or some such thing like that, and see what they were saying editorially about the President's policy in Vietnam, about the President's trip to China, about his vetoing an HEW bill. And oftentimes, by calling that input to the attention of the administration, that resulted in a letter. If it was, in many, many instances, if it was a very positive letter, or a positive editorial, then a letter would be sent from the President to the editor or the publisher of the newspaper. Well, and that doesn't go with just the relationship with the papers. Isn't just the people who we consider were with us through all of our major crises, I suppose. Attention was also paid to those papers, which I would consider somewhat hostile to the administration. We didn't just choose to ignore them. We worked with them and provided information for them and communicated with them. And in this way, they become the link with the community. And I think that this has been an extremely viable function of Herb Klein, was to reach out, to meet with the editorial boards when he was in that state. He never went into any state for a speech without allowing an hour before or an hour after his engagement to talk with the editors and publishers of the papers in that area. So you can see, if he were going into Des Moines, Iowa, to give a speech to a 4-H club, we would notify the newspapers that he was going to be there and arrange for, I had nothing to do with that was done through his scheduling, But we provided the background on the newspapers. We, for example, we would have gone and looked up to see what the Des Moines Register was saying about the administration editorially. And if we found that they, for example, had taken the president to task for mining the harbors in Haiphong, then perhaps all it would take was Herb Klein to sit down with them at an editorial board meeting and explain to them on a background basis exactly how this came about, what was done, and why it was done. And many times it will not necessarily turn their thinking around, and this is not, was not done to brainwash anyone. This was simply done, if you read their editorials, there was oftentimes they just, you know, were reaching out, and it was just an emotional reaction to something. And as all of us have at times, I'm sure. And surprisingly, not all of the papers agreed with the president, which was very, very interesting. You know, we kind of fight with them tooth and nail all the way through for the last 4 years, and then suddenly they come out with a glowing editorial for him asking that he be reelected. So while they chose to disagree at times with the president, they must have respected the manner in which he handled the office. And I think that that's probably one of the largest contributions that Herb Klein has given to the president and to the American people. I think it's been well worth it. It's been very hard for him. He's traveled, he's been in every state in the last 4 years, and sometimes as many as 3, 4, 5, 6 times.
Donna, the information that you would compile for him, would that be in his files on these various trips, or I don't know what you would call it, his appearance file per se? Would we be able to go into that at some point and see all of the information that you would have compiled and collected for him? And, could we assume that outside of the actual speech, that hopefully the copy of we would find in there, and some of the other scheduling activities, all the information in there on whatever would be something that would come to
your
office?
I would hope that that's what you're going to find when Mr. Klein decides to leave the administration, whether it's in 1976 or whether it's, you know, a year from now or whatever. I have nothing to do with maintaining his trip files. That is done through other people on the staff. They schedule him. They agree to speaking engagements. Once that is locked in, then I go to work. What you should see, in other words, what we did during the campaign, and we did this because Jenny and Herb were, in 3 months, I think they were only here about, I think being facetious, but it seemed like only about 2 weeks out of 3 months they were actually in the office in and out. They were traveling. So what we did, starting from the day the convention ended, we went back after the election and started through our appointment books, and we took, put the schedule in, the speech in, where he went, and the backup material for that speech. In other words, where it came from. Not in every single instance, but if he was, during the campaign, if he chose to attack Mr. McGovern on Vietnam, we may have put in some excerpts from the Republican National Committee that had been sent over by them, that had been done by their research department, to show where we got our information. And those were done, and those are now in his hands, in his files, not in this office, but in his office. Now, I assume when he leaves that that will all be transferred to archives. I, after the election, after the first of the year, actually, I boxed up a large number of materials that were used during the campaign, and they are labeled as such, but there's no stipulation on them as to what they were used for. I mean, it says 72 campaign material, or McGovern, or Muskie, Teddy Kennedy, or Spiro Agnew. It's
research material that may have been used, but perhaps may not have been used.
That's very true. Although, simply because this office is so small, we didn't keep too many things that we didn't use. If something came into the office and I thought it was junk, I threw it out.
Okay.
And again, that's a storage problem. I mean, Terry, my...
You may have done the president his library a favor having thrown it out now, because in effect, what remains then is, based upon what you've just said, we can assume had some impact, however small, in the material that you collected for Mr. Klein.
I think when you get to my material, which was box after box after box, and of course you saw that room downstairs of all those file cabinets.
51 and a half?
Yeah.
In the basement, yeah.
That was Susie Lowe's contribution to the archives, and she kept everything, but she did keep things well labeled, and that was, but I just didn't see the need for all that material. For example, so much of that material in those file cabinets was just editorials. The only advantage is that they were editorials by subject matter. So you could almost take from in a chronological order, you could see from 1969 when the president took office, perhaps, had I maintained them, probably up through phase three of the new economic program. You would have been able to see, you know, the changes. Now, I did not maintain those files because there were two reasons for that. Space was one, and the second reason was I felt that it was rather ridiculous to duplicate what Mort Allen was duplicating. This was the whole thinking. And in many instances, this was a criteria for what I kept and what I didn't keep, was what was Mort Allen keeping. I can't stand duplication, and I kept saying to myself, because I had you and Jack looking at me every once in a while, you know, maybe I ought not to throw this out, but it got to be it could get to the point where we get out of hand. You know, my inbox every day is two of these. Now that's just material that comes in through the mail. People sending in newspaper editorials, columnists sending in advanced copies of columns, but it still has to be gone through. 95% of it I throw out. 5% of it is usable material, and material that we must act upon in some manner.
Well, I don't think anybody would find any fault with you for what you've disposed. I think if Herb Klein's files have been retained and kept, and the material that went into his speeches that you prepared would be there, that's sufficient enough. We can assume that very little would have escaped your attention in terms of what has appeared on television or in print. Just because it is not perhaps in these files that you accumulated does not mean that you were ignorant of it. It's just that you chose not to keep it or chose not to use it.
There's one thing that, and you're going to have to take that up with him, but I'll put it in for the record, and he can have my neck later. Herb, it must be understood that Herb does not speak from a prepared text.
That was one of the questions I was going to ask.
He speaks very extemporaneously. The only time we ever prepare a text for him is when we are releasing excerpts to the press. And that means that we have an excerpt of something he wants to say of some import. If he is going to take Congress to task for their attitude over the impoundment of funds at some speaking engagement, say tomorrow night, then we would type up a brief statement, maybe 2, 3, 4 pages long, which would be inserted into his general remarks, but we would release it to the wire services, to a number of newspapers, and this type of thing. And you can close that door if you want now, Terry. I think the button is gone. It gets a little stuffy in here, though, I must admit.
Well.
But those we have, and those are in the files. Over and above that, there are many times when I will provide only for him a 2-page outline on where we are at concerning some particular subject that he feels he wants to address himself to. And then from there he picks out his talking points. Now, what we do get back in return, in most instances, we request a tape.
Good.
Now, going back to what I originally said, he has those tapes. They have not been transcribed, but there are boxes and boxes and boxes of them. And what he chooses to do with those, I have no control over. I mean, we simply, you know, that's something you people will have to take up with
yeah.
him upon his departure.
Do you have any percentage figure to give us in terms of how many of his speeches have been recorded? Does every last one of the groups that he speaks before record it?
No.
50%?
Oh, I would say we have 80% of his speeches.
And hopefully...
Those would be formalized speeches. That's not, you know, where he might go up and address the Capitol Hill Club at a luncheon now. I would say it's rather doubtful. I had nothing to do with that either. Had I been in charge of that, I would have handled it a little differently. But it was always one of those things that I had to keep after Jenny on, to be perfectly honest. I'd say, did you, you know, be sure and ask for the tape. And it's one of those things that's easy if you're not thinking about it. When you've got all this traveling and scheduling and everything else, you know, you somehow will forget. Now, the other problem is that I found that people will record it, but they forget to send the tape in. You know, instead of picking it up as soon as a guy is through with his speech and sticking it in your pocket, there's a habit of walking off and not bothering with it. So that means that the organization has to send that, you know, to us. And if they don't send it to us, then we're out of luck. But I would say we have probably 80%. And we, the most important thing to me has been were those 3 months of the campaign where we were turning out excerpts for every speaking engagement that he had. We have those. They are in the files. And because the president, I think, was a very historic campaign, and so I'm pleased that we do have everything that he said during those 3 months from August till November, from the end of the convention till November.
That's very encouraging. As far as the tapes go, hopefully we can work something out with him on those. I think our position would be that since he was acting in official capacity, those are the property of the president, but you know as well as I do that sometimes it takes more than that logic to get those into our custody.
Yeah, well, as I said, you will have to take that up with him because I have no control over that. I simply maintain them, and it's certainly not my position, at least I don't feel it is my position to turn those over to anyone. If I'd had my way, and it was one of, you know, I first brought it up, nobody reacted to it, and I was very sorry about this, but I wanted to take those tapes and have them transcribed and leave one set for archives and one for him. But as maybe you're well aware, it is like pulling teeth out of an elephant around this place to get them to transcribe anything. And the number of times he was out speaking, you'd have had to have one person full-time transcribing. And Herb is not an easy person to transcribe. Because he does not speak with a prepared text, his speeches sometimes are not extremely cohesive. They sound cohesive when you listen to them, but when you read them, they are not. And so therefore, things become disjointed to a certain extent, and something that will sound very smooth when you're listening to it to your ear will not look smooth on a piece of paper. And the ones that I have had three of his speeches transcribed in 2 years, and that was for distribution because he made some news with it, and therefore they wanted the speech. And he wanted them to have it. Now, after almost every speech he'd give, we would have requests for those, for a transcript. And unfortunately, this is where we were, I think, our weakest, in my way of thinking, the weakest link in the chain was the fact that we were not able to provide to those who requested, whether it be a student in a university or a columnist, or from a specific newspaper or whatever, a transcript, because we had the tape, but we had to get it transcribed and then Xeroxed, and it would have had to have been edited. We could not have just given it to them right off the tape. So you can see the problem, and he's one of the few administration people who can stand up and talk for 20 minutes without a piece of paper in front of him, 30 minutes, and then take an hour of questions and answers without any notes in front of him.
Would these question and answer sessions have been included on the tape?
Yes.
Sometimes I think those are far more informative than comments, although if he's not really speaking from a prepared text, he may have had even more to say in his speech than someone who would just be reading from his
That's
speech.
Right, and I've noticed when he's talked, which is interesting, you know, he'll start to read an audience. He can tell when he's losing an audience, and he can very quickly adapt himself, which is very interesting to watch. In other words, he's not hung in there. Now, I was out, trying to think. I had to go up to West Virginia and address to Key Club International. And about halfway through the speech, I realized, first of all, I had gotten wrong information from the White House. I had been told I was going to address a group much older than what I was confronted with when I arrived there. And unfortunately, I had prepared remarks. So I went up to the room, and I had about 2 hours before the dinner, and I had to revise my prepared remarks right then because I realized that I would lose them. But I just didn't have enough time to bring it down to their level. And I realized about halfway through I was in real trouble, you know, and I finally just threw the thing out and went on. And I picked them back up and got their interest enough that we had a good Q&A session. But it was a very panicky type of situation, and I think many administration officials are like that, unless they have that piece of paper in front of them. And there's been two people that have impressed me with this, with the fact that they can speak in this manner without anything and retain the facts up here, and that has been the President of the United States, President Nixon, and Herb Klein. John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson used to walk up there with their pieces of paper, you know. Richard Nixon doesn't do this. And I think that's another sidelight of my own. I think this is why he kind of puts, at times, appears to put his foot in his mouth. Because he walks in, well, as you well know, he has his Q&As prepared for him prior to a press conference by Pat Buchanan. But nevertheless, you can never be quite sure just what they're going to ask. And he goes in with a no-holds-barred. I think only once or twice have I ever seen their questions limited, and I believe that was once in regards to Vietnam, and once and always in regards to the selection of Vice President Agnew in terms of him remaining on the ticket in 72. He said he would not make any comment on that until after a certain period of time. And other than that, it was, I'll take any question that you have, where my feeling was is that President Kennedy and President Johnson at times planted their questions were planted, as well as limiting them to certain questions, as well as always making an opening statement that pretty well at times could cover, particularly with John Kennedy, he would cover the gamut of any major crises of that particular moment, which left nothing for the newsman to ask except trivia. And certainly, I don't mean this in a critical way. I'm just pointing out the difference between the kind of person that can talk extemporaneously without the need of notes and the person that cannot. And I think that Herb is very effective. In fact, he's terrible when he has a text. I have to say that. He's terrible. He looks down, and we tried to put a text into his hands once just after I came here, and it was terrible. I told him never again, and he said, I agree with you. Because he likes to look at his audience, and with the scheduling the way it is and his moving around so much, he has no time to commit anything to memory. I mean, he can't commit a whole text to memory, so there's no other way for him except to stand up and say what he has to say. And it always hangs together extremely well. He always has something important to say.
If he's going to make a 30-minute speech, Donna, to collect the information for that 30-minute speech in terms of statistics and the details and the technicalities, do you have any rough idea how long it takes to collect information? I know it varies from one speech to the next depending upon the topic, but...
It also depends upon how much time you have. It's very funny, Terry, and... you know, I'm being totally serious. If I have 3 days to prepare him for something, I will take 3 days. If I have 30 minutes, I will take only 30 minutes. And this has happened. I would say the average is it takes approximately one day of solid activity for two people. And that would mean Buttons doing a lot of the legwork and my doing a lot of the analyses and typing as far as excerpts and ideas go. And that means also that I have to get in to see him to have him approve certain things, this type of thing.
So you'd start with telephone calls to various PIOs and the agencies involved, NSC or what have you, maybe the organization that he's speaking to?
That's right. I can give you kind of a rough idea of just about how we proceed, or at least how I proceed with it. I am told usually...
Open this door.
Yeah.
See what you mean about the heat.
Can you reach, I always have to get Ed in here because I can't reach, the heat is on.
I've noticed that. The air conditioner does work?
Yeah, you have to push that thing real hard. Can you turn that?
Which way? Straight up?
No, this. Turn that knob. The heat's on. That's it.
See what happens.
Yeah. Well, I don't let it cool off just a minute.
All right.
Come back.
No hurry. I'll just turn this off for a minute. Test 1, 2.
Well, let's see, I think we were talking about rough idea of how long it took you to prepare some of these.
Well, essentially what we start with, Terry, is the fact that I am notified that he is going to deliver a speech to, say, the California Press Association. Following that, what I usually do is talk to him as quickly as I possibly can to find out if he has anything particular in mind that he wants to discuss. And he will usually give me a few ideas as to what he wants to talk about. And it's usually something he will, in terms of, say, the Press Association, he may want to talk about the press a little bit. However, he also may want to talk about foreign affairs as well. Or he may choose to talk about an issue of the day. If the president vetoed the HEW bill the day before he was going to speak, why it's fairly obvious that he may choose to say something about that. So from there, I usually come back to the office and I place a call to whoever issued the letter requesting he speak to them. And I ask that person if there's anything that they would particularly be interested in hearing about. Sometimes they say no, anything he wants to. Sometimes they're very specific. They'll say, yes, we'd love to hear about the president's trip to China. We'd like to hear about what happened on the SALT talks. We want to know how Vietnam is. Can range in that fashion. From there, I also find out who else is going to be on the podium with him. And that pretty well sets it up for me. If I find that his ideas and the organization's ideas are pretty similar, we're all set. If they conflict in some way, if there's a conflict, then I have to backtrack to some extent. I think only once or twice have we ever not touched upon that which was requested by the organization. And if I remember correctly, that was in terms of Vietnam. There was just nothing to say at that particular time. He obviously, for obvious reasons, was in no position to comment. And that's really virtually the only time, because it's amazing how many times after talking with him before you go to the organization, his ideas will fit in with what they want to hear about. It was almost rather ironic. It was as if he'd already talked to them, which he hadn't. So then from there begins your work. If he was going to talk on SALT in Vietnam, then I would get a hold of our Vietnam specialist on the NSC and ask for a background or an update. If, for example, the speech involved a congressman or a senator on the podium, then I would certainly give him some background on that senator, be he a Democrat or Republican. If he were a Democrat, it was always very important for me to contact our congressional people on the Hill and find out what his presidential support record was and this type of thing, because, you know, irrespective of party, there's always something nice that you can say if you have the right information. A couple of times I never could find anything nice to say about a couple of them, and we just had to choose to ignore it, because sometimes there's two or three congressmen who were extremely anti-war, very liberal, and, you know, no matter what the president had done, would never agree with him anyway, and it's very difficult. And you would find yourself occasionally on a platform with someone like that.
That was going to be my question, how often did this occur?
Oh, very rarely, but I would say probably in 2 years, two or three times, I got really hung up on an individual. I just put in big letters in a memorandum, don't open your mouth, don't say a thing, just say, hello, nice to see you. But Herb always likes to compliment someone or kiddingly kid someone, you know. He'll work a joke around a congressman. Jack Kemp is a very good example of someone. He and Jack Kemp, Congressman Jack Kemp from New York, are very good friends. And Jack is, Herb would find himself very often on a platform with Jack Kemp if he were in New York. And Herb could have a real good time kidding Jack Kemp because of his professional football career, but also of his accomplishments in Congress and this type of thing. And Herb has a very keen sense of humor. And I've seen him, you know, break some Democrats up too with his sense of humor. But there were several occasions when he was better off leaving well enough alone.
On those occasions when there was someone else at the podium, would you attempt to get some hint from them as to what the subject of their presentation would be, or the thrust of it, or whether it's going to be light, serious,
heavy? Right. Well, again, Herb was always the main speaker, with very rare exception.
Even with congressmen or senators?
Yes. It was usually the congressmen and the senators that were on the podium were usually from that state in which he was going into, and if it were, say, an International Kiwanians Convention being held in Toledo, Ohio, it's quite possible that you would attract two or three congressmen and maybe one senator. And they would be there as part of the VIP guest list, or they may be presenting an award, or they may have just a few remarks to make, an introduction to Herb Klein. They may be introducing him. Most occasions of speeches, he was the guest speaker. And on occasions where you would find him with other administration people, this happened occasionally, where he would find himself on a podium with several cabinet members, and they were addressing themselves to such and such. I would always make a point of calling those offices and finding out what, say, Secretary Rogers was going to address himself to, what, that's providing the letter didn't stipulate. Sometimes a letter would stipulate a subject or a topic, but if they didn't, then I would usually call one of their aides and say, ask them what they, so that there was no overlapping. And that happened, I can remember it happening with Secretary Richardson, the GW, he found out, I vividly remember that, because we almost got caught on that one. We were addressing ourselves to the same things before it finally occurred to me to, I better find out. I'd gotten pretty well started. It's a good thing I didn't get a call. Because I found it's a lot easier for Herb to adapt to than it would be for perhaps someone else. Because he can have, one of the funniest things I ever remember was the fact that, I can't remember the exact circumstances, but this is how well he can adapt. He got up on a podium and he was sitting there and he was finishing his dinner and he was kind of running through his mind what he wanted to talk on. And he said he was making just a few notes on an envelope, which he then in turn sticks into his pocket and never uses, but he kind of makes an outline of what he wants to say, from thank yous to funny remarks to, he'll have maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, that'll be his 4 key points, and then a conclusion. And he was sitting there and they were going on with awards and this type of thing, and finally they started to introduce him and they said, "And our director of communications for the White House, will be speaking on, and they threw a subject at him that had nothing to do with what we had been told. And I listened to the tape of it, and he really got himself out of it beautifully. But we'd spent about 2 days preparing him for this, and I will never forget that as long as I live.
Was it totally off the subject?
Yes, it was. It had nothing to do. He was going to speak on foreign policy, and they hit him. They were a group of, not foreign policy, I'm sorry. They were a group, I've got foreign policy on the mind. Let me see if I can get this right. They were a group of house contractors or home contractors or something.
Home builders?
Home builders or something. Let me see if I can get this right now. Anyway, I had gone to HUD. I know it had to do with houses, and I went to HUD, and I got all this information on housing starts and where housing was and lumber and all this business. And it turned out that these people dealt with highways, but they had the same title. It had something to do with houses or something, but they actually were involved with building highways and transportation. And I'm telling you, it's okay, Terry, if you suddenly are going to talk on China and you get the Middle East thrown at you, you can BS for a while. But when you get into something as technical as housing and building of highways, you're in a lot of trouble. And I never saw anybody get out of something so smooth in all my life, and he did.
How long did he have to speak?
20 minutes.
20 minutes. That's a long time.
Yeah.
You're not prepared.
Well, fortunately, he said he was in a good mood. He said, but you see, it was a misinterpretation on everyone's part. If I could only remember, I've got it. Well, it went down to archives, I guess, when I packed up. I was going to say I kept the file. I kept the Xerox of it, as a matter of fact, because it had to have been one of the funniest instances.
Where was the, remember where the speech took place? Was it, you have any idea of the approximate date? Was it during the campaign?
No, it wasn't. It was last summer, and I think it was in June of last summer, if I'm not
where?
Mistaken.
Any idea?
Yeah,
it was
in California. I'm trying to think of the association that it was that he was speaking to. I wanted to say Home Builders, but that isn't it. It has this funny name. It's a contract. It had the word contractors in it. But it was something that you would automatically associate with building a home. And we'd spend all this time on that because that was something I knew nothing about. I had to rely particularly on the agencies for that kind of input. And we looked at the economy and all this business in terms of the future of housing and the lumber industry and the whole ball of wax. And so he was, I said, well, Herb, you know, it was kind of funny because when he came back and he was telling me about this, I said, well, didn't you realize that this had something to do with highways before you got hit with this between the eyes? And he said, Don, I was sitting there eating my dinner and I had my mind on something else, admittedly, and I wasn't paying a lot of attention, and I just knew I had to make a few notes about, and I'd read over your stuff before I got to the thing, and I knew what I wanted, but I just had to kind of put it in an order, and that's what he was paying attention to, and he wasn't paying any attention to what was going on prior to his being introduced, apparently. And,
well, even at that point, it would have been too late, two or three more minutes to worry and fret.
Fortunately, he didn't scream at me. I was so happy because when he told me that, he told me over the phone, first of all, and it's hard to read him on the telephone. And so when he came back, you know, I thought, boy, I'm going to really get it. And that had to be the all-time
classic.
Well,
if that's one of the highlights, if that's the one that we should look to as an example of how well Herb Klein can get up and speak off the cuff, and we'll make a point of locating that.
Yeah, that's a dandy because I guess that has to be the funniest one. There's been a lot of funny incidences because Herb is such a funny guy anyway, and I don't mean that facetiously.
No, I understand.
Very easygoing, easy to get along, tremendous sense of humor, takes everything in stride. Nothing ever seems to tremendously rattle him at all, and that's why he's been a pleasure to work for. He's a lot more disorganized than I am, and sometimes that gets to me. but it never gets to him. You know, if he has to leave something till the last minute, he does, and he always does a good job with it. But his sense of humor, I think, has carried him through more terrible situations, things that I think I would have just been totally glued over. Because, oh, another funny story, and I have to put this one in. This was some time ago, too, and he was up in New York, and he had gone to the Yale Club. And he had spoken at the Yale Club, and I was not with him on any of these, so I'm just kind of recounting from memory what was recounted to me. But after the talk was over with, he was scheduled to get to a telephone and do a 5-minute talk show over the telephone, Q&A, while he was running late, as Herb Klein always does. That will be his distinction until the day he dies, and probably the mark left on the administration is Herb Klein is never on time. But he was running late. He knew he had to get to a phone and call the radio station. So apparently one of the members had handed him a drink in this conference room, and he was having a drink afterwards, and he suddenly remembered this. And so he goes tearing out down the hall with this guy after him, and he spots a paid telephone. So he's got a drink in one hand, and he's only got like 2 minutes to make this call and connection. And this man is saying, but Mr. Klein, you can't stand out here with your drink, because it was against the Yale Club rules. So anyway, he wasn't paying attention to that. He said, well, his classic comment to the man was, is he said, I didn't go to Yale. And he just kept right on. And so he makes this phone call, and he's fumbling, and it was long distance to Connecticut. That's where the telephone hookup was coming. And a radio hookup was. So he places a call with a dime. I believe it was to Connecticut, a radio station in Connecticut from New York. He calls up and get on the line, and he gets the guy he's supposed to be talking to. Now, it's difficult to explain this part of it, because unless you understand radio hookups and how they do this, you know, how they talk to an administration official from California on the radio and then play it back over the radio, but it was live. And he's got a glass in one hand, the phone in the other, and probably knowing Herb, pockets full of papers and this and that, and the phone number in front of him on a scrap of paper. So the guy asks him a question, and then just as he's getting ready to answer, the operator comes on the phone and says, please deposit 15 more cents. And he reaches into his pocket, and he's looking frantically because he knows he's on live on the radio, and he can't find any change. That's another thing. Herb never has any money in his pocket. So he's trying quietly to motion Jenny Brown over, and he's got this drink in his hand. And I said, why didn't you put it down on the thing? And he said, I don't know. It just never occurred to me. He's frantically motioning Jenny, who's talking to this man who told him he couldn't drink out there. So she can't figure out. She thinks he wants a pen, so she reaches into her purse, hands him a pen, and this operator saying, please deposit 20 more cents, because now he's run over the 15-cent level. And this, finally, the man on the other end of the telephone said, Mr. Klein, would you please give us your telephone number, and we'll call you back. And that's what he did. He hung up the phone and stood there at the pay telephone in the Yale Club, and the radio station phoned him back. But that was another one I think I'll always remember, because I can see him standing there, really pretty unflustered about that whole situation.
No,
yeah. I mean, he said he was concerned because he was getting frustrated because he couldn't find any money and he didn't have any free hands. He was trying to hold on to the telephone, and Jenny wouldn't cooperate because she didn't understand what he wanted. And but those were two very humorous stories.
I think there's a lot of insight into Herb Klein that I've never met the man, so I have no idea what he's like. I've just seen him. He's evidently a different man in person than he strikes me as, just seeing him in the hall. He looks very quiet, somewhat very serious, almost an introvert to me in the hall when I pass him. It may simply be because he's preoccupied.
But I think that's his nature. I would never call him an introvert, but he is very quiet. He is very soft-spoken. I think in 2 years of being here, I have probably heard Herb Klein say the word damn or hell 3 times.
Is that right?
That is all. I have never heard him exploded anybody, if he is upset about something, you know, you wait for him to come at you, you know, but he won't do it. He'll let you know that he's unhappy about something in a very, very quiet way. He'll say, well, now, we have a little problem on this, and maybe next time around, you know, I think maybe it might be better if we do it this way. You know, it's never, sometimes you wish he'd blow up at you,
yeah,
you know, and just because you feel more guilty about something, I think, when he tends to be very quiet like that. And as I say, as far as, you know, using a swear word or anything like that, the worst I've ever heard him use is damn it, hell, and I would say 3 times is the only time I've ever. And then it's always in a very quiet, it's never in an explosive way, it's just almost in a sheer frustration. When he's walking down the hall, he can look very intense. He's walked right by me at times, and I know his mind is spinning. All you have to do is look at his desk to know he's going in 8 different directions at once. But
Donna, before I forget, would you be in a position to describe the organization of Herb Klein's office in terms of the people and generally what each is assigned to do, so I've got a little better feel for who did what, your position vis-a-vis the others? Can that be done?
Yeah.
I don't know if his shop's that organized.
I can give you a very rough sketch. I think that it would be far better if say, Herb or Margita White, who will be leaving soon also, explain to you the entire organizational structure. But what it actually consists of is Herb Klein, of course, at the top, within our complex, our compound shop or whatever. Then the deputy director, Ken Clawson, who's next in line, and Margita White, assistant director. And Margita, function is I would say, a day-to-day maintenance of the office and troubleshooter. She oftentimes picks up for Herb and filters a lot of the mail through to him, answers a lot of letters that must be answered with his signature that he can't possibly get to, oversees a lot of the staff problems, if there's problems type of thing. And let's see, then we go to Stan Scott, who has just recently been appointed as special assistant to the president. But he was an assistant director to Herb, and he handled all of the black press, both printed media and electronic media. And minorities, I guess, is majority would have been black, but it did encompass some minorities until last summer when Carlos Conde was brought on as a staff assistant. He dealt with the Mexican-American press. Then there's Al Snyder, who is primarily involved with the electronic media. He schedules her for television radio shows. He schedules other administration speakers, anything dealing with the electronic media. For example, when Meet the Press wants someone from the administration, they will call Al Snyder. Barbara Walters wants to interview the president. She will call Al Snyder. This is his function. Ed Blacksmith is a staff assistant, and he serves there again. His role is kind of a troubleshooter too. He is responsible, or has been responsible, for setting up many of the briefings that we've had for the newsmen. He begins it, follows it through, and sees that it winds up. And this has played a key role throughout the 2 years, I'm sure, that he's been here with the number of briefings we've held for the news media. Wanda Phelan, who's also on the staff, is primarily responsible for creating and writing letters for signature for the president, also for Herb Klein. She is the one who takes the editorials from around the country and determines whether they deserve a presidential letter or not. And this is determined by the content of the letter, or of the editorial, and then she also keeps cards whereby you can look back and see the last time that the president communicated with the editor or the publisher and what the subject was. But in addition to that, she also prepares the editorial reports for the president on major issues. In other words, following the announcement at the end of the war in Vietnam, we collected, I don't know how many hundreds of editorials from papers all over the country, and they were excerpted. So it would say the Washington Evening Star and then an excerpt and the date of the editorial. So you would, the president could very quickly look through and see what the trend was on a nationwide basis towards his initiative. And this is done, was done, say, for the China trip, the Russian trip, the pieces at hand statement, the end of the war.
This would include important domestic events also.
Yeah, I'm trying.
Wage and price.
Yes, wage and price
phase
control.
Phase two.
Yeah. These would be extremely major.
Reorganization or the budget or something of that nature. Now, how does that fit in with the president's daily news summary?
That has nothing to do with the president's daily news summary because you're dealing only on a one-shot deal. I mean, you're looking at the editorials only from one day. If the president announced the ceasefire, he announced it at 10 o'clock at night. So therefore, that was early enough for the West Coast papers to get a good lead story and probably editorial in. So the next day we were able to, the LA Times, for example, carried an editorial. But it was too late in some instances for some morning papers who had already gone to bed to editorialize it. They could still headline it, but they could not editorialize it. It didn't come out until the next day. So our papers would cover the day after the announcement and the following day. And then we also picked up, this was an exception, of course, we also picked up the weekend papers because they all did big spreads on the whole Vietnam War over the past 10 years, for the most part, the Sunday papers did. And so therefore, when you try to compare it with Mort's operation, the only way that you can compare it with Mort is that he does excerpt some editorial comment, but he focuses primarily on the straight hard news and also on columnist comment as opposed to editorial. That's the difference. He's concentrating on that aspect where we are attempting to concentrate on the editorial aspect.
Okay, that's clear. I'm glad you made that distinction. I think that's one of those questions that I wasn't sure of myself. So, but well, I didn't mean to sidetrack you now.
No, that's people? This one. Now, let's see, that Wanda was literally, I'm trying to think, and I guess that's really of the major staff. That's I've already talked about what Jenny Brown did, his confidential secretary, is responsible directly to Herb and scheduling and traveling with him, which is a full-time job in itself.
The staff that has been with Herb Klein since you arrived here, have there been many departures or changes, Donna? Now, early on in the administration, he had the responsibility for coordinating the various departments and agencies on information going out to anybody and everybody. I understand that responsibility over a period of time shifted over to Colson. Is my understanding of that generally correct?
That's a hard question to answer, Terry, because I had nothing to do with that. Now, I do know that from my own observation that Kathy Ballston was primarily responsible for the mailings. However, they went out under Herb Klein's signature with a covering letter. And then again, Kathy Ballston was on Charles Colson's staff. But everything, I would see her down here quite often, having things approved. And I think everything was subject to Herb's approval, but it was done by a gal who was on Mr. Colson's staff. Now, the lines of responsibility and Herb himself, I think, would be best answering that, or perhaps Margita White or Ken Clausen, because they dealt in that area where I did not.
Okay, well, I don't mean to pin you down. I don't no, expect
it's,
an answer.
No, it's just that I do know that everything went out under the cover letter of Herb Klein. And there may, you know, it was being disseminated to the press, and it was probably very appropriate. But the gal who was primarily responsible for putting this material together was a gal named Kathy Ballston, who happens to be on Mr. Paulson's staff. Now, I do know for a fact that Herb would initiate many of these things. He would say he would want this done, and it may have been that it just carried over into that staff as opposed to someone on his immediate staff doing it, because there you get into, quite frankly, a rather large mailing operation, because it's not going to just your Eastern press. This is going out to editors all over the country, major initiatives.
I know I talked with a fellow who's a White House fellow who was evidently involved in this early in the administration, called Rod McCall. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with him. He was evidently involved in this. And I know when I interviewed Paul Costello, he talked about it too. I think in both cases, well, specifically in McCall's case, he had started with client staff, and then slowly but surely found himself in close and staff. So,
I still think that it's controlled to a great extent within Herb's prerogative, but I'm not sure. That's something that just has to be determined by them, because just to be perfectly honest with you, I just never got into that area. I don't want to get into it.
You've got more than enough to do. Another question, and I was time's really going. Did you have any sort of daily schedule at all, Donna? Could you come in the morning and assume that you've got a Herb Klein meeting with his staff at 8 o'clock, followed by perhaps a session with Margita on something, and then the rest of the day was just doing whatever was necessary?
No, the only regimentation I had was the own regimentation I set for myself. There were certain things that were very regular, and normally in between 8 and 8:30 in the morning. I read through some 10 Eastern papers first thing, cover to cover, and that would be the, just to name a few, the Post, of course, the Washington Post, the New York Times, Christian Science Monitor, the Wall Street Journal, Chicago Tribune, Baltimore Sun, New York Daily News, and
any of the Florida papers?
No, those are only the papers that come in daily for us. First thing in the morning, they're there on our doorstep. You know, they've been delivered in one big package. And the other part of the regimentation would be the cutting of the wires. They have to be done on an average of 4 to 5 times a day, and Buttons usually handles that. The wires are cut, and 14 copies of the wires are made and distributed to people on the client staff as well as other individuals within the building. The vice president's office, Mr. Colson's office, this type of thing. Mort Allen's office receives a copy.
And you would be reading those all three of them, I take it?
Yes. Two. We have UPI and AP. We have 4 wires, but only 2 wire services. We don't have Reuters. Sometimes people have a tendency to say 3 wires.
I would assume that.
I believe that Signal has Reuters. It seems to me I've had to call on them 1 or 2 times, and I think they have Reuters coming in there, but we don't have the machine itself.
In terms of the average time when you'd arrive in the morning, you'd leave at night, I assume this would vary to such a degree that there's probably no general time.
Well, I can give you a pretty general time. In the last year, I never left the office much before 7:30 at night. And I always worked almost every Saturday, and sometimes on Sunday.
What time would you come in the morning? 7:30, 8 o'clock?
Usually between 8 and 8:30. And then, to be perfectly honest about it, during the 3 months of the campaign, it would be as early as 6:30, 7, and sometimes as late as 11 at night. And from the end of the convention until the day of the election, we never had a weekend off. We worked Saturdays and Sundays. So the hours were, fairly standard. And even now, I don't leave much before 6:30 at night. But I'm usually in between 8 and 8:30. Now, right at the moment, I've become very lazy because I'm in that lame duck position, and I'm in the midst of packing at home, and I'll zip out of here at 5:30 or 6:15. And I've noticed myself becoming increasingly later in the morning. This morning it was about 20 minutes to 9 when I got here. You know, it was, you know, I think it just goes in line with the fact that you are leaving and they're taking your desk away from you. And, you know, you're sitting over there in the corner with the boxes. That's your office with the boxes there and the phones piled up. And, you know, you just, but.
Well, I've got an idea of the number of hours you put in a day. It sounds.
I don't get paid for the number of hours I'm putting in here.
That's
about all. That's the only way I can answer it. And I don't think there's too many people that are.
Have there been any magazine or newspaper articles about you specifically, Donna, and the job you've been doing that you feel are worth mentioning?
No, they did one when I was down at convention. I'm not sure it's worth mentioning. And. Other than that, I stayed away from them. I had no desire to get involved with the press. I mean, I like working with the press and on a professional basis, wanted to. And my hometown newspaper has done several things, and then Copley did a syndicated story on me down at the convention. But that was as close as I ever wanted to come because I got my feet wet at convention. I had avoided this and avoided it and avoided it, and I finally couldn't because the reporter happened to have been a very close friend. I'd known since I was in high school. So I thought I was, you know, inviting her over for a drink of old friends, and suddenly the syndicated story appears, and boy, at least she, you know. I was careful anyway about what I talked about, what I said. As I didn't care how old the friend is, when they got newsman tagged across them, you tend to be very careful. But nevertheless, when I think about some of the things that I said as a friend would to a friend, and your personal feelings on certain things, I realized about halfway through that this wasn't just, I was being grilled, as they say. And that was for, you know, and as it was, she didn't misquote me, but she left out a lot of things. Yeah, a lot of qualifying statements, and it, you know, it was more or less a human interest type of thing. It wasn't, certainly wasn't anything that was going to get me in any trouble, but I was, you know, I've never said yes until that point, and then that soured me for the rest of the time.
Did you have him?
No, that's not mine, that's Anderson's, I'm sorry.
The name of this person, or any way that we could perhaps try to find a copy of that, or if somebody stumbles across it.
Oh, I have 4,000 copies, Terry, here.
Well, seriously,
no,
if you've got
I do have a copy at home, I don't have one here. But if you're really that interested, you're welcome to have it.
If it sheds any light at all on you, Donna, yes. And, you know, who knows, our research at some point in the future may come up and say, I found this article on Donna King. Well, does she ever mention it? We'll at least be able to say, oh yeah, that's the one that she told us about. It's okay to be careful of it. So that's the advantage of having that.
Well, you know, I'd be more than happy to bring it in. And
well, if you can think of it, please do. For the record, how can we reach you 5 years from now if we want to do some more interviews with you? Do you have a permanent address in California? I'm sure RNC will always have your address.
Well, that's going to be a problem to say where I am in 5 years because I don't know where I'm returning to in California. Right, I'm going to my parents' home temporarily, but they're in the process of selling their home. I suppose probably the best thing to do would be to give you their permanent residence in Northern California where they are planning to retire. And then as long as they live, I'm sure they're going to be in this particular place, and I'm sure that it's a small enough town that even if it's a wrong address and they move within the town, it would carry the same name unless I were to marry or something like that. You wouldn't have any difficulty
reaching. Fine, well, we'll take it.
Okay. You want it right this minute?
Yeah.
I've got to get my. They just moved up there, so.
Our hope is that, when I use the term 5 years with advisement, hopefully we'd like to be able to drop little cards to people every year or so and say, while we're still here, are you still there? And we're going to be in the areas, or a chance to come by and just chit-chatting with you or something like that, so.
Okay, Terry, it would be Mr. or Mrs. Benjamin Kingwell. And then the address is 76 Madrone, M-A-D-R-O-N-E.
Street, lane,
no,
road?
No, nothing, just,
nothing.
And it's Olympia Glade, O-L-Y-M-P-I-A, and then G-L-A-D-E, Mobile Estates. And Grass Valley, California. And it's 95945.
Do you have any brothers or sisters, Donna, that would have an address and would like also?
Well, I can, you know, it's
again,
almost...
Are they going to be very transient for the next 5 years?
Well, I have a sister that's married and, you know, they're in a rented home now, so I don't imagine they would be there five years from now. And my other sister is in an apartment and she's, you know, it's possible she would be there in 5 years. But
well,
what I could do, if it's of any help to you, once I am located, you know, I can at least send an address back to you, or if you would, you know.
I hope not hope that you will have the RNC will always have your address. If not,
I don't think they have my address over here. It's taken them 2 years to get the right room number on the mail.
Well,
but
California state politics, I suppose you'll always dabble in that. So.
Well, yeah, I'm giving very serious consideration, I think, to trying to go back into private business after I leave here for a while anyway, and it's really just a quirk on my part. It's the only reason I can, so many people say, well, why? And I think it's just to allow me to sit back and reflect upon what I've done for 4 years. It's, when I was in state politics, local politics, I always said I wanted to see everything from the national level, and now that I've seen everything from the national level, I really don't want to work in politics for a while. It's a very draining profession, and it's a very rewarding profession, don't misunderstand.
Oh, I understand.
It's just, I think that you have to walk away from it for a while, just as, you know, and everybody looks at you very odd, in an odd way, but I think the only thing I can ever bring to mind is the fact that President Nixon, in essence, kept his hand in it for 8 years by campaigning for state candidates, but he walked away from the national scene for 8 years, and I think this, by his own admission, allowed him to grow and to mature to a certain extent and allowed him to become ready for the presidency. Now, I'm not doing that. I'm only using that as an example. I think there are things that I have disliked and have kind of disillusioned me to a certain extent. I can't deny that, and I have to be very honest.
Well, everybody's got their own personal opinion, so I'd be a little skeptical if you said that you agreed with everything.
No, I don't, and at times it's been very trying. And I think I don't think I could ever walk away from politics, but my feeling is, and the reason I'm leaving at this particular time, is that if I don't go away now, I'm afraid I might become so disillusioned that I wouldn't appreciate it. And that's been kind of part of my personality all the way along. I've had to walk away from certain things to learn to appreciate them. I didn't go to college right out of high school because I was bored with it. I started and quit, but then after 2 years I decided that's what I wanted and I went back and I did very well and I liked it and that type of thing, and that seems to be my personality. It was a long, hard campaign. The war has been, to my way of thinking, the hardest thing in my mind to adapt to. Sure. Oh, help yourself. Why don't you take one of those rolls?
Well, I have one, I guess, somewhere.
In one of your boxes?
One of them.
And, you know, You wanted it over so badly, and yet you found yourself understanding the reasons why, but it didn't, why it could not end, when we wanted it to end. But it became very upsetting after a while. You have to put a lot of faith in the person that's leading this country, whoever it is.
Well, I understand your desire to get away from it. I don't think it's all that difficult for anybody to appreciate that. I think all of us at some point have involved something. It's like cramming for final exams. Well, you need a break after that. And I'm sure that this campaign was very much like a final exam.
Yeah, it was. It went on and on and on and on. There was just no Friday night parties. That was a problem. But you know, it's of course I always felt that way from the moment I came to Washington. I loved Washington and I still do. It's like living, and people have said this over and over again, but I think it really is a fact. It's very dull to go away from Washington. It's like being in the center of things, and not just because you're here at the White House. When I was at the National Committee, you knew what was happening. You knew something was about to break on the wires. You felt the tension in the air. You just knew something was going to happen, even before it was announced. It was the way the wires read. It was the indication. You go to California, and you listen to it on Walter Cronkite. You know, it becomes a very blasé type of thing. And I found that when I went home for the holidays, that I would make up my mind I wasn't going to read a paper for a week, I wasn't going to listen to the news for a week, but it was like an obsession. You had to know what was going on, and I think I'm going to regret leaving after a period of time. I think I'm going to miss the excitement, but
they will come back.
No, I said I wouldn't come back unless it was first class all the way. There's only two positions that allow you first class in this city. I don't think I'll ever achieve those, but it's been a remarkable experience. I don't know how Richard Nixon stuck with it for 30 years.
This is the thing about him that amazes me, is that dogged stick-to-itiveness that he's got to have.
And to have the perceptiveness that he has now. You know, a lot of people could stick to it for 30 years, as witnessed by many of your statesmen and by many of your senators and what have you, not only here but throughout the world. But the older they become, the worse they become too. And he doesn't. He gets better as he gets older. Better and better and better every day. And it's an incredible thing to watch happening. And I think that that's what I'll miss, is watching it. Watching the doors that will be open in the next 4 years that I think will be open, particularly on the international scene. You know, people say, what's he going to accomplish after Peking and after Moscow, and after ending the war? What is there? Well, there's so many things and so many doors to open yet, and I think that it's going to be a very exciting time in our history. People that aren't interested in foreign policy, I don't care one bit about domestic politics. I agree with the president when he says that Congress can take care of the domestic politics, but you need a president to take care of foreign policy. And it doesn't excite me. There's no excitement to it. And so what happens, I think, will just take care of itself, you know. He'll write a budget, Congress will pass a budget, he'll fight over it. But, you know, if he can restore relations with, even further with China, and open up some of the third world countries, we desperately need work in Latin America, and I think we will see this, and also with our African nations. Cuba is a very interesting toy to me right now, because he campaigned on the fact that, as of the moment, he foresaw nothing. But yet today, on the news, we've achieved probably the greatest breakthrough we've had since Mr. Castro took over, and that was the fact we reached an agreement on the hijacking.
I didn't hear about that.
There was a bulletin just before you came in. I haven't read any of the text of the agreement, but they apparently, working through third parties, achieved an agreement. Now, to me, this means a step and easing tensions with a country that is so close to our border and encompasses so many people, even the President's valet is from Cuba, I guess Spain originally, but his home was there.
Now, let me ask you a couple of questions. I overrun my time. I'm about to run out of tape. Buttons will be taking over your responsibility, or do you know yet who will actually be fulfilling this?
I don't know. As of March 2nd, when I leave, if there is no one else to assume my responsibilities, I'm assuming that she will take them over until such a time that that is, or whether she will be able to carry on. I think that the Butts can carry on. She may have some problems, but then Agnes has been moved over here too to encompass or to enlarge the research division. So, you know, between the two of them, I think that they'll have a good operation.
I hope that there weren't any other special projects that you worked on that are historically significant. If you say yes, I'd always turn the tape over, but for your sake, I burned you out to stop
the one,
for sure.
The only other thing, and there's not much to add really to it, but this I consider historically significant. It's not just what little I've contributed to her. He's the history to the administration. But I did write text speeches for Stan Scott. And I find that very significant because I was a Caucasian writing text speeches for a black man addressing himself to black audiences. And I wrote some.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah.
Can you recall the time of Alan Drury? Doubleday, I know,
Doubleday. Yeah, okay.
How did you come to receive this assignment from Stan?
It was an accident. He got into a bind one night and he didn't have time to write his own speech, and he came in to me, and it was about 5:30 at night. He said, "You gotta bail me out." I said, "I can't. You know, how can I possibly put myself in your shoes? I mean, it's tough enough, Terry, to write a speech for someone that you know well. And in fact, you cannot, it's impossible for some speechwriters, and I do not consider myself a speechwriter, but from what I have read about them and talking to Pat Buchanan or Bill Sapphire or someone like that, there are certain people that you cannot write for even though you are a speechwriter, you know.
Hi, did you find my cookie?